I called this Twisted Logic, subtitled, Beware of the Doctrine of the First Glance. You'll get what I'm saying, I think, toward the end, at least I hope. I hope you do, or I've failed. But, you know, if you've ever engaged someone who refuses to face the facts, who comes up with arguments to, you know, express their points, tactics, excuses to avoid the truth, you know what I'm talking about. And it happens a lot, especially when you're engaged in discussions of the word. And especially the emotionally charged topics that sometimes come up in religion as well, because we take them to heart and we want to believe what we believe is right. So when you can spot faulty reasoning, and more importantly, understand how it fogs the issue and throws up a whole bunch of smoke screen, then you can kind of see what's going on and cut through that fog. We're better equipped to counter error as we go out and teach Yahweh's word. When their children ask why they have to do something, many parents will say, because I said so. This logic is known as the bare assertion. I have the upper hand, so do what I say. End of discussion. It's all about status. Who has the greatest status in this world? Is it Queen of England, President Trump, Vladimir Putin? How about Yahweh, the great I am? And when Yahweh says, you obey my word because I said so, end of discussion. We say, thank you, Yahweh, for your word. It has all sorts of blessings for me as well. In 1600, astronomer Galileo was advancing the theory that the earth revolved around the sun. This put him in direct conflict with the Roman Catholic Church. The church's position was that the Bible is the inerrant word of Yahweh, and it contains verses indicating that the earth is stable and the sun, you know, rises and falls with it. For more proof, they showed that the earth also was the center of Yahweh's plan, so it had to be the center of the universe. And therefore, the sun revolved around the earth, they said, to which a serious debater or Bible student from Missouri would have followed up with, show me the biblical evidence. So the church said, Ecclesiastes 1:5, the sun also rises, the sun goes down, and hastes to its place where it arises. The average person would be forthwith silenced by this and say, okay, you're right. And they were, but not Galileo. He had a shiny new telescope and lots of evidence to prove his argument that the earth revolves around the sun. At this point, the honest Bible student from the Show Me State, of course, would have said to the church, maybe you have the wrong interpretation of the scripture. Maybe you're not looking at it right. Maybe you need some tweaking of your point. Well, Galileo also believed in the inerrancy of the Bible. And so the problem, as he saw it, was the way the church interpreted the Bible. The church was very literal when they said it supported their doctrine, and then very figuratively when it didn't. Many say this was the beginning of the strife between science and religion, between reason and faith. So keep in mind that other notable names of Galileo's day, like Martin Luther and others of academia, also disagreed with his views. But he held to them because he thought he could show them what he saw, the evidence that he saw right there in the sky. Well, the church actually won because they had the power to win. The bare assertion actually made them right, they thought, because they had the power to be right. Today, I hope to demonstrate other sleights of hands and twisted logic to deceive you into believing certain things, maybe even error. This isn't anything new. Neither is it something you're unfamiliar with. You may find many people in various walks of life using these arguments. It's everywhere, from the Supreme Court to your neighborhood car salesman to the nightly news. They're all using twisted logic to push a point. Even your favorite priest or minister, except the present company, of course, but in some ways, it is dishonest. It doesn't show the total truth. Believe it or not, twisted logic is virtually a part of being human. When people hear an issue discussed, they expect twisted logic in some of that. It's part of our culture. It's how we persuade people. Even you have done it, and maybe still do it, and will do it. You win arguments every day with various kinds of this type of logic used, which I want to talk about today. I'm always amused by the positive spin that realtors will use when they're selling a house. You watch them in action, the guy's talking to him says, well, you're showing me a home that exceeds my budget. And the realtor says, yeah, but look at this ensuite. Look how beautiful it is. He says, wait a minute. I just told you, I can't afford the house. Yeah, but, and he tries to get him off center there and you know, convince him that he should go for it anyway. It doesn't matter how nice the bathroom is. He's just trying to ignore the buyer's comments by pointing out something over here and bamboozle him a little bit. Ignore the argument altogether is another twisted logic tactic. Ignore it altogether. Then there are a lot of tactics used in putting forth a claim, but we'll cover only some of those that are common in doctrinal arguments. Why study the art of twisted logic? Because we need to understand what's happening when people talk to us, debate us, argue with us, and know what they're really doing and how to break through their argument, break through their point. We need to know how to deal with various approaches and how certain arguments fall flat and which ones are not based on fact but are simply our rhetorical house of cards. One of the biggest tricks in doctrinal polemics is suppressed evidence. You see it all the time. Not telling the whole story. You pick and choose, leaving out the part that weakens or contradicts your point. Children do it all the time when they're caught doing something wrong or trying to persuade their parents to give in to something. Why can't I jump off that cliff into the lake? Everybody's doing it. Suppressing the fact that last week a guy jumped off, hit his head, and now he's paralyzed. Politicians love to suppress evidence. They call it looking into things positively or looking at things positively. They only tell you the spin that serves their argument. Then, of course, there are the misguided preachers. I was listening to a TV preacher one time trying to tell me that 1 Timothy 4 allows me to eat a ham sandwich. The man began by reading verse 3. Forbidding to marry and commanding to abstain from meats, which Elohim has created to be received with thanksgiving of them which believe and know the truth. For every creature of Elohim is good, and nothing to be refused, if it be received with thanksgiving. Stop. That's where he stopped. So as long as you offer a prayer before eating, you can eat that shellfish. You can have it. But he didn't finish reading the passage. Verse 5 says, for it is sanctified by the word of Yahweh. He didn't mention that part. Sanctified means set apart by Yahweh. What isn't set apart? Unclean food is not set apart by Yahweh. Look it up, Leviticus 11, Deuteronomy 14. So, that's the part that they did not show. He did not show. And, you know, clerics will suppress evidence all the time. All the time. We're under grace, not law, shouts the evangelist. Read Ephesians 2, 8 to 9, which says, for by grace are you saved through faith, and not of yourselves. It is the gift of Elohim, not of works, lest any man should boast. But Mr. Easy, the evangelist, doesn't read the next verse. For we are his workmanship created in Messiah Yahshua unto good works, which Elohim has before ordained that we should walk in them. That we should walk in them. So there's something Yahweh, a standard Yahweh's established that he wants us to adhere to. He didn't say that. He didn't go into that. But the masses are so used to hearing one-sided stories, they often don't notice it. They don't know anything is amiss. They may even expect it. The liberal media use suppressed evidence all the time when they cover the Arab-Israeli conflict. Maybe there's a war going on. What do? They show all the destruction in the Gaza or all the destruction in Lebanon caused by Israeli bombs. But rarely do they turn their cameras around and look what's happening in Israel. Thousands of Hezbollah rockets just destroying parts of Israel. They don't ever show that. They want sympathies for the Arabs. I guess if the Arabs worked on their aiming skills, they'd probably do even more damage. But anyway, we were taught in journalism school to give both sides of the story. That was clear. You had to give both sides of the story. And if you didn't, the editor hands the story back to you and says, rework it. You didn't do it right. Not to drive a political point of view by picking and choosing what we want to report, which happens today. You got a big F if you did that, if you ever tried that. But that's no longer how news reporting works, sad to say. We're in a dishonest culture, and now much of the news is propaganda with only a small core of truth there. Where media make up the news and, of course, have no interest in checking facts. We're in a danger zone, brethren. We really are. We're in a danger zone. In religion, deceptive teachers are good at ripping from the context certain verses and passages that they make appear to support their false teaching. Proof texting, they call it. Well, our desire here is to get to the truth, to harmonize completely the entire Bible. Make a passage fit the entire Bible. Make it fit, not pull it out and establish a teaching on it. For example, Sunday supporters will suppress the fourth commandment. They ignore the lifelong practice of all the apostles, all the prophets, Yahshua himself, who kept the seventh-day Sabbath every week, all their lives, and just completely ignore that. And instead, they focus on a few verses like 1 Corinthians 16:1, yanking them from their context and say, whoa, Paul advocated worship on the first day of the week. So let's pull it back into context and read it. Now, concerning the collection of the saints, as I have given order to the assemblies of Galatia, even so do you. Upon the first day of the week, there's a Sunday, they say. Let every one of you lay by him in store as Elohim has prospered him, that there be no gatherings when I come. This doesn't quite sound right. And when I come, whomsoever you shall approve by your letters, them will I send to your, bring your liberality unto Jerusalem. They tell you this means passing the offering plate at church on Sunday morning. That sound like to you what's being said here? The first day of the week. And so that proves Sunday worship. That's a big one. They use that one all the time. Wait a minute. Paul said to set aside contributions on the first day of the week, not to drop them in a church collection plate. He says, do it on the first of the week in advance of my coming. The word day has been added by the translator. So it could be Sunday, Monday, or Tuesday, first of the week. In advance of my coming, that first of the week, it is only assumed to be Sunday. And there's nothing remotely connecting worship on Sunday with taking up an offering of aid for those who are suffering in Jerusalem, because that's really the whole point of it. Third, why would Paul, the middleman, be going around gathering offerings for the collection plate and not the people themselves when they, the typical practice is they go to church, pass the plate, drop your offering in the plate. Why the middleman? What are they doing in there? That doesn't make any sense. Who are these guys needing letters of endorsement to do that, to drop your collection into the offering plate? Well, the whole thing is a straw man. Let's look at the rest of the story, as Mr. Harvey used to say. Romans 15:26. The fact is, Jerusalem had fallen on hard times, and there was a dearth going on. 15:25, but now I go unto Jerusalem to minister unto the saints. For it has pleased them of Macedonia and Achaia to make a certain contribution for the poor saints which are at Jerusalem. So he's in Macedonia and an area, and he's asking for help. Help these people. Give them some foodstuffs. Help them. They're in a bad way. They need help. They're starving. Same thing in Acts 11:29, when the disciples, every man according to his ability, determined to send relief unto the brethren which dwelt in Judea, which also they did, and sent it to the elders by the hands of Barnabas and Paul. They're not talking about an offering at church. Where there is contradicting evidence, typically only certain evidence is presented, you see. They twist it on the wings of a deceptive spin. Suppose we all did this. What kind of world do we have? Suppressed evidence, probably the most common tactic used in biblical argument. They don't tell you the whole story. Like the guy that sat in the back of the church, minister made a point, and he says, read the rest of the verse. Of course, he ignored him because it disproved what he had just said. Another twisted logic technique is the hasty conclusion, which is often used these days, especially on those who are not studied. In this, you present a little bit of evidence, then jump to a conclusion. Take the rapture teaching, for instance. It rests heavily on 1 Thessalonians 4:16. For the master himself shall descend from heaven with a shout, with the voice of the archangel, and with the trump of Elohim, and the dead in Messiah shall rise first. Then we which are alive and remain shall be caught up together with him in the clouds to meet the master in the air, and so shall we ever be with the master. See, there's the rapture, they say. Huh? Not so fast. When does Yahshua come back? At the last trump, right? 1 Corinthians 15:52, in a moment, in the twinkling of an eye, at the last trump, for the trumpet shall sound, and the dead shall be raised incorruptible, and we shall be changed. For verse 53, for this corruptible must put on incorruption, and this mortal must put on immortality. There are seven trumpet blasts that are going to take place before Yahshua comes. These angels are going to sound. There's plagues associated with each one on this earth. Find in Revelation chapters 8 and 9. All humanity goes through the first four plagues. It isn't until the fifth plague that Yahweh seals his people with their name, with his name in their forehead. Then they're protected. Is there a rapture there? You tell me. Then Yahshua returns at the last trumpet sound. No one has gone to heaven through all these six trumpet plagues. Well, yeah, but before that, he's going to come back secretly for his saints, they say. Back to 1 Thessalonians 4:16, where we find him returning with a shout, a voice of an archangel, a trump of Elohim. Nothing secret about that, and doesn't say anything about two returnings. Two second comings at the end. There's no evidence anywhere about a dual return. The first time in secret to snatch away his people in a rapture, and the second time to come back bodily or in himself to come back. Like the square peg in the round hole, the rapture believers have, they've created that one in order to make the rapture fit their beliefs. Not to mention that if a rapture is to protect people, why are the dead going first? Dead need protection? They're dead. Amazing how easily some buy into things. They buy into things. The hasty conclusion. They don't think it through. Oh, that sounds good. Yeah, I guess you're right. They don't look into it. It's very effective when the audience is ignorant of the facts. When the audience doesn't understand the issue and can be bamboozled. And this is what the Roman church did from the beginning. They had one Bible. It was chained to the pulpit or whatever. You couldn't read it without a priest behind you, watching and explaining to you what it says. Because it's in Latin, by the way. And who knew Latin in the Middle Ages? Nobody, except maybe the priests. So you suppress evidence. You can't figure it out. And that's why the Reformation made them so mad. Because they actually gave Bibles. I was watching a program on Tyndale, the first English Bible. And they hated this guy. They finally burned him at the stake because he gave a Bible to English-speaking people that could now read it themselves. No more suppressed evidence. There's one main reason for the success of false doctrines. That reason, the reason it's so successful, is that people don't study. They do not study the word. They just go along with tradition and what their church has taught. If they studied, they'd probably be like all of us here. Thinkers, not accepting the status quo until we proved it. But they don't study. That's not an excuse. That's an indictment. Hosea 4:6, my people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. You reject knowledge, I reject you. Boy, that's pretty solid, isn't it? That's pretty ominous. Many profit from mass ignorance of the word. You see it all the time. Teachers of error bamboozled by using theological terms that nobody seems to know. Based on Greek or Latin, they don't understand it, but it sounds good, you know. Throw around terms like apologetics, preterist, eschatological, parousia, Christology, sola scriptura, sola fide. Why don't they just tell you what it is? Why do they have to use these code words? Ooh, you're smart. I wish I was that smart. Whatever you say, you're so knowledgeable. Well, the hasty conclusion is most effective when the audience wants to believe the message. They want it anyway. So it just merely just needs a little provocation and they'll jump right into it. This brings to mind another tactic of twisted logic, the unprovable phenomena and the unknowable generalities. It's everywhere in advertising. People in the know use and trust Easy Clean, the most trusted name in cleansers. Who are these people? What do they know? How is it the most trusted cleanser? Did they question every American as to their trust in cleansers? I call this pure malarkey, the hanging comparison. It's the better picker-upper. Better than what? Straw broom, sticky tape, wet dish rag? Evolution is the most logical explanation for the existence of the universe. Compared to what? Fairy dust? Hanging comparison. They don't finish it. It's virtually impossible to prove the non-existence of something, like the missing link in the theory of evolution. The evolutionist would say, well, the missing link just hasn't been discovered yet, but it will. Well, it's been how many billions of years, according to you, and they haven't found it yet. All the evidence points to one, but it'll be found. So their theory is no more than blind faith. It's a religion. Guess what? It's a religion. It's not a science, because the science says you have to take and prove, demonstrate what your supposition is. If your supposition is evolution, then put it in a test tube and test it. They can't. They can't prove it. It's too late, I guess. So you can't prove it. It can't be a science. According to the definition of science, it's got to be tested. You can't test it. So it's a religion. Blind faith. So by the same token, neither can anyone disprove the existence of Yahweh or that Yahweh does not exist. All Bible students must weigh evidence. Think of yourself as a jury hearing testimony. I remember Brother Paul once said, you know what? I'd like to see someone, a panel like a jurist, and go through some of these doctrines and have people giving the testimony, and then they can decide. Would be a good way to do it, I guess. We kind of do it in different ways, but okay, now there's the red herring, another propaganda device. In a red herring argument, you intentionally digress from the real issue, introducing a side matter that has nothing to do with what's being talked about in an attempt to deflect attention away from the real issue. Look over here. It's often so subtly done, it's called changing the subject. My sister used to accuse me of that.
You're changing the subject.
When we were growing up. I guess I was. See, we all have our faults using some of these things. You've seen it. You engage someone about which day is the Sabbath. Their response, I keep every day holy. That's not the issue. I'm not talking about you, what you do. What does Yahweh's word say is the proper Sabbath? That's what I want to know. Yahweh made the seventh day as a Sabbath to keep holy. Not every day. He commanded 6 days of the week to work. He didn't make every day holy. We'd all starve to death if we kept every day holy. Take another red herring. You show that his name is Yahweh. Oh, yeah, but he has many names. He has many names. They avoid admitting that Yahweh is his name, first of all. They will never admit that. Why don't they say, that's his name. Yeah, it is. But he has many names. They never go that far. Instead, they sidestep the point. Show me in the Bible that he has many names. I want to see that. Many names in the Bible where he says, I have many names. I can show you where he says, my name alone is Yahweh in Psalm 83:18. And by the way, that's the Tetragrammaton in the Hebrew, one of three places in the King James where his name is transliterated from large capital letters. The others are Exodus 6:3 and Isaiah 26:4. So there it is in the Hebrew. Then there is the combining of the red herring with the false comparison. Now we're really getting into it. Maybe a senator introduces a bill cutting welfare payments to the undeserving, the ones that are just going along for the free ride. Someone says, that guy's a Nazi. So that must be what Nazis do. They cut aid to the undeserving. Well, of course, that's just name-calling is all it is. Just name-calling, trying to get you to think negatively about the guy. The faulty comparison is especially used by the grace alone crowd. You explain that Yahweh expects obedience from his people, as he says he does, as he tells us. And the response is, what, are you trying to earn your salvation? Where did that come from? I like to say, do you think I'm better? You're better than me? You know, you keep the law. The response is to question your personal motives. Not the facts. Not the facts that Yahweh says, obey me. The facts that he laid down, his laws, 6,000 years ago. It's another dodge, another sidestep. Throw you off track. It's an avoidance move, a red herring. When you're in one of these discussions, don't allow them an easy out. Put their feet to the fire and say, come back. Wait a minute. Let's answer this point. Let's answer this scripture. Don't try to dodge it. That's when they get mad and stomp out the room. So, sometimes you don't get anywhere. Obedience has nothing to do with earning anything. We understand that. We're saved by grace. Obedience has nothing to do with legalism. It's about pleasing Yahweh as he has commanded us. It's about pleasing the one you worship, to be found worthy of his blessing should he decide to choose you one day for his kingdom, as we find in Luke 20:35 and 1 Thessalonians 2:12. Well, how about attack the messenger? When you have no comeback, you're completely lost for a comeback, what do? You attack the person you're debating. Politics is well-versed in this. In this last election, I got so tired of hearing the other side being slammed personally over and over and over. In the election year, they called it ad hominem, a Latin term meaning to the man. You're now attacking the man, the person, not his argument, not what he's saying, but you're attacking him. You're a fool. You know, you don't know anything. Has nothing to do with the point. Maybe I don't know anything. What's the point? Explain it, you know. Of course, demeaning someone does nothing. It's adolescent. It's cheap. It's childish. And defies Yahweh's word. They did it to Paul in Acts 24:5. For we have found this man a pestilent fellow and a mover of sedition among all the Jews throughout the world and a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes. It's kind of like, you know, when they brought Yahshua before Pilate, the Pilate or Herod, and he says, what's this man done? Well, if he wasn't guilty, we wouldn't have brought him here. What? What has he done? Well, can't you see? He's here, so he's guilty. Again, smokescreen. They said Paul is deadly. He foments rebellion. He leads a cult. Basically what they said. Then there is the straw man. I love that guy. I don't know how they made that, but it's not really straw. You build a straw man when you misrepresent your opponent's position by adding your own flaws to his argument. You see this in politics all the time too, to make his position easier to attack. So they do that to you too. Oh, you're trying to earn your salvation. See, they can say, well, you don't earn it. And they can go off that tangent but not answer the question. They create a straw man when they say, so you say along with the commandments and feasts, I need to bring a bull to sacrifice when I worship on the Sabbath? I didn't say that. So I need to keep all 613 laws? I never even said there were 613 laws. Where do you get that? Well, that you could possibly keep them all anyway. For instance, if I go to out and not suffer a witch to live, I'd be swinging from the gallows myself. Can't keep that. That's for a government. Those are government laws. For the guy listening to the debate, the straw man can be a powerful mind changer because he doesn't realize what's happening. Because it's very deceptive. It manufactures a point that they can demolish. It manufactures something they say you believe, and then they can just destroy it and not even have to answer your point. Then there's one called the ad populum. Appeal to popularity. My uncle did that when he joined the Catholic Church. They're the biggest, they got to be right. Then there is the idea that more people who believe it, it's got to be true. Got to be true. This is the fallacy found in many commercials. The ad says, buy our detergent. It is preferred over 2-to-1 by women who know. Women who know what? Show me the survey results and who you surveyed. Because that makes a difference too. There was a book years ago called How to Lie with Statistics. And it all hinges on your approach. All hinges on the questions you ask and who you ask. I can go to New York and I can have a survey, maybe a conservative survey, and get a different response than if I go to Missouri, because it's a different demographic, a different clientele. Same questions, different results. A survey shows that 70% of Americans believe in the Trinity. Therefore, it must be right. But why do they believe it? Because they checked it out? Or because it's been hammered into them all their lives? And how do they define it anyway? You can define the Trinity 6 ways from Sunday. And the church had to figure it out. They hammered it out through church councils, trying to figure out what is the Trinity and what is the essence of the Messiah and is he divine? And they're still talking about that today out there in internet land. Yahshua warned of wholesale deception out there in the world of religion. The doctrine of the Trinity developed out of polytheism or belief in many mighty ones. If you go back into the church history, you'll find out that's where it came from. So you have 3 mighty ones instead of Yahshua and his father. Yahshua and his disciples and their new covenant faith were vastly outnumbered by the religious establishment. Many, many thousands to one. Did that make the opposition right? Or did that make Yahshua right? Yahshua said in Luke 12:32, fear not the little flock, for it is your father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom. Little flock. But the flock has got it right. So where does that leave the large flock? And the huge numbers. Historically, in religion and elsewhere, the majority is usually wrong. In grammar, you have what is known as the non sequitur. Here's an example. Driving to town, my hat blew out the window. that's an interesting image. My hat driving the car to town. That's what it says. Driving to town, my hat blew out the window. In rhetoric, a non sequitur is when a conclusion is drawn which doesn't follow from the premise. Non sequitur is a general term for a bad argument, which a lot of these already are, but I stumbled across a website called Church Without Religion. Church Without Religion. Down below it said, our message is simple, J-E-S-U-S plus nothing. I found a non sequitur there. Because Webster's defines a religion as belief in a divine or superhuman power to be worshiped and obeyed. If you say you follow Yahshua and neglect the obedience he taught, you're not following Yahshua, by definition. A church without a religion is an impossibility. It's self-contradictory. Watch for the non sequitur when the argument doesn't follow the premise. Then there is the big lie. Keep repeating the same falsehood over and over and over, even for millennia, and people will believe it. Massive repetition is essential. Why do they keep running the same stupid ads over and over and over on TV or on the radio? People get sick of it. Why do they do that? Because it works. It works. People, despite the nonsense, it still creates interest in their product, and they remember it. I remember years ago this Mr. Whipple squeezing Charmin. I heard it. It just went on for years. It's so stupid. But it worked. Apparently it worked, or they wouldn't be spending billions of dollars to put Mr. Whipple on there squeezing Charmin. You know, it's a fact of human nature that outrageous lies are sometimes more believable than the small ones, just by virtue of their bodaciousness. There must be something to it, because the claims are so over the top. Where there's so much smoke, there got to be fire, people think. All right, how about obtuseness, refusal to follow the argument? When all else fails, just stubbornly refuse to see your opponent's point. Close off your mind, build up a wall, and no matter how good his arguments might be, no matter how many good points he makes, you just aren't going to listen. Just ignore it. Pretend it doesn't exist. Change the subject. And do not in any way recognize that it even is there. Or say, I don't know about that. Just kind of blow it off. Unless you stubbornly draw them back to your point. Sometimes that's very difficult. You're going to be caught in an endless circular argument, and you're going to go nowhere. In John 8, we find that Yahshua had the same problems we sometimes do in convincing others of the truth of the word. And it can be frustrating, but it helps to know during those times that we have the best ally in the universe, Yahshua the Messiah. Verse 45, because I tell you the truth, you believe me not. Which of you convinces me of sin? And if I say the truth, why do you not believe me? Why do you close your mind off? He that is of Elohim hears Yahweh's words. You therefore hear them not, because you are not of Yahweh. Sometimes you just have to dust your shoes off and go on to the next town, because there's nothing there. It's a dry hole. They aren't going to listen. They don't care. And you can go over and over and over endlessly with a, you know, trying to convince, they don't care. You're wasting your time. Go to those who do care, which is what we try to do. Well, I pray that the next time someone tries to pull the wool over your eyes, that you have better insight into what's happening, better insight into the tactics that are used, the propaganda that's used, the methods people use. You know, Yahweh's word is powerful. It's a powerful sword. It doesn't need trickery or propaganda. Yahshua said, preach the word. He wanted the word to be taught. We're told to be in season, out of season. Rebuke, exhort with all long suffering and doctrine. It stands on its own. You don't have to use techniques or suppressed evidence or ignoring different things, or whatever it might be. We can be certain it pleases Yahweh if we stand on his word, as Yahshua did when he refuted Satan. He just quoted scripture. Did he think he's going to convince Satan? I'm sure he knew he wasn't. But the best thing about it is it was an example for us. May Yahweh bless you.